Consumer Affairs Committee, and we'll open a, a work session on Senate Bill 81. Janet, can you give us a rundown again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 81 was the bill that was introduced at the request of the Public Utility Commission and would allow the public public utility to charge different rates at a customer's option for their energy bill if differences arise from an optional schedule or a tariff that takes into account a customer's past energy uses and provides an incentive to encourage the change in a customer's energy usage. It's a permissive bill. The bill was heard on May 11th, and there was no opposition. We understood at that time that there were going to be amendments proposed dealing with Klamath Basin Project irrigators, and the Senate Bill 81-3 amendments were routed to your offices. Those amendments were jointly drafted by the Klamath Basin Irrigators and Pacific Corp, and they deal with if current contracts expire and are not renewed, deal with the rate increases and mitigating those rate increases over the next 7 years, starting in 2006. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Sean Miller and Matthew Perkins, please? Oh, and Senator, what's it? Yeah, you're okay? All right, thank you, Senator. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, for the record, representing Pacific Corp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. With me this morning is Matt Perkins, who is an attorney representing the Klamath Off-Project Water Users Association. You, as Janet indicated, you should have received the -3 amendment. We are asking for your consideration and support of the -3 amendment for you today. As many of you know, the Klamath Basin irrigation contracts entered into in 1956 are the subject of regulatory proceedings at the Oregon Public Utility Commission to determine whether the contract rates will terminate on October 16, 2006, next year. If, as Pacific Corp contends, the contracts do expire next year, the irrigators will see a substantial increase in their bills. This amendment is designed to help mitigate the impact of the higher rates customers would experience as a result. Pacific Corp and our customers served under the 1956 Klamath contracts worked together to fashion a bill ensuring that in the event of the cessation of the contract rates, the customers will gradually phase in a standard tariff rate. The bill in no way prejudices any party's position regarding the validity of the 1956 contracts. This change in law is needed to ensure that the Public Utility Commission has the authority to address the rate shock that may arise if the 1956 contracts are terminated. Under the bill, the phase-in is gradual but limited to 7 years. Only the meters now eligible for service under the contract rates may receive the rate mitigation, and the mitigation costs are fully recovered on an equal basis from the utility's other customers. We agree here and in the future proceedings that under this bill, Pacific Corp is entitled to recovery of the full costs of the mitigation credit. Thus, if different states allocate the cost of the credit in a manner that creates a cost recovery shortfall for Pacific Corp, under this legislation, Oregon customers would ultimately be responsible for these costs, as well as the cost of the credit directly allocated to them. Again, all the stakeholders have worked on the -3 amendment language. I put a lot of hard work crafting this path to ease a transition to the standard tariff rate. We believe this is fair and a reasonable approach to this unique situation. Again, this concludes our joint testimony submitted for the record, Mr. Chairman. At this point, I'll turn it over to Matt. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Matt, please go ahead.
Thanks, Sean. For the record, my name is Matt Perkins. I'm here on behalf of the Klamath Off Project Water Users. We appreciate your consideration of the amendment this morning. The purpose of the amendment, from our perspective, is to help prevent a potential economic disaster for farmers in the Klamath River Basin. Over 50 years ago, Klamath River Irrigators, Pacific Core's predecessor, and state and federal governments struck a bargain regarding certain hydroelectric facilities of Pacific Core on the Klamath River. Under this bargain, Klamath River Irrigators received a special contract rate for power in exchange for things like pumping water from pumping groundwater for irrigation in order to basically ensure there's surface flow in the river for use in Pacific Core's hydroelectric facilities. Last November, Pacific Core filed a rate case here in Oregon and indicated that the contracts were expiring or that they were going to ask the contracts to be terminated and to switch Klamath River Irrigators to standard irrigation tariffs. The rate increase that would result if Pacific Core's proposal is approved is over 1,200% for Klamath River Irrigators. Times are already tough for these communities down in the Klamath River Basin, and we feel like this would have a serious detrimental effect on the farming community in Klamath River Basin if the contracts are terminated. As the joint testimony indicated, there's a significant dispute about whether the contracts can be terminated, and that process is being played out at the OPUC right now. We see the amendment to the bill as a safety net in the event that the contracts are terminated. While the bill does not preserve the low-cost power that these irrigators have enjoyed for the last 50 years, it will help ease what will probably be a painful transition if they are moved to standard irrigation rates. This is definitely a compromise between Pacific Core and the off-project irrigators. We work collaboratively to draft these amendments, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. Any questions? Representative Kitch?
Sean, I have a testimony here from the chairman of the PUC, Lee Beyer, in support of this bill, but it's dated May 11th of 05. When you said all stakeholders on your testimony on the last page have buy-off, does the commissioner support this as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, we worked real close with the Public Utility Commission on the language as well as the governor's office in our discussions. Although I will not speak for the PUC, I know Rick Willis is here if you'd like a formal position on their part, but I know we worked real close, and it's my indication, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Could I have John DeVoe and Jay Ward, please?
Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
My name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive director of Water Watch of Oregon. And I'd like to give you a bit of a different perspective on this bill. Water Watch opposes this bill for a number of reasons. We are one of the parties in the PUC proceeding. We are also before FERC, which is dealing with the relicensing of the Klamath project. We oppose this bill because it creates an exception to Oregon's prohibition against utilities charging discriminatory rates found in ORS 757310. This is a serious action that should be taken with full discussion of the issue. The bill substantially undoes this important protection for Oregon's electrical ratepayers in order to fulfill a short-term goal of subsidizing one narrow special interest group, the Klamath Basin irrigators. The proposed amendments would, in effect, mandate, as law, continuing discriminatory electrical rates for these irrigators with a price tag of approximately $20 million over the term of this soft landing. Water Watch is not necessarily opposed to a soft landing in concept. However, we believe the state of Oregon, the ratepayers, and the resources of the Klamath Basin ought to get something in return for this $20 million investment. And as we see it right now, this bill does none of those things. It simply shifts the cost to other Pacific Core ratepayers, and it preserves a discriminatory rate for a period of 7 years. The bill does not mandate any specific rate. In fact, these parties can continue to litigate before the PUC to see their discriminatory rates continue perpetually. And in fact, that's what the off-project irrigators have argued just last week before the PUC. As you know, there is an extreme water crisis in the basin. We believe that these low electrical rates are contributing to production on marginal agricultural lands, which is causing excessive groundwater use in the basin and which is exacerbating the groundwater crisis in the basin. There are other interests that are also affected economically by water use in the Klamath, including Oregon's coastal fishing communities, which have recently had to apply to the federal government for emergency relief due to the closure of the salmon season because Klamath salmon returns are so low that the entire fishery is closed. We're seeing losses of up to $30 million a year in those communities. And until we solve the water crisis in the Klamath, those communities are not going to see healthy fishing seasons. So I would tell you the amendments don't provide certainty to Oregon or to anyone else what the rates will actually be paid by these irrigators, and they don't resolve any of the pending litigation. This bill just says if there is a certain outcome at the PUC, then this soft landing will kick in. Neither do the amendments provide any resource benefits, such as better power or water management in the Klamath. And this bill will actually undermine attempts to forge a creative solution to the problems that are presented in the Klamath right now. Some have tried to characterize our position as anti-agriculture or as trying to put people out of business, and I want to be clear that nothing could be further from the truth. And in fact, the only analysis that's been done on these rates that's looked at the effect of a power rate increase on agriculture has concluded that people will not be going out of business if rates go up. And I'm pointing to the Yeager study from Oregon State. It's titled Energy Pricing and Irrigated Agriculture in the Upper Klamath Basin. It's a July 2004 report. And I'll close with a quote from that report. Quote, overall, the analysis indicates that most of the irrigated lands of the Upper Klamath Basin, and in particular those lands within the Klamath Reclamation Project, are highly productive and would continue to be profitable to irrigate under energy prices and fees currently paid by farmers in other parts of Oregon and Northern California. Indeed, the viability of agriculture in the region does not depend on current low energy prices, although these prices do provide significant benefits to landowners and owner-operators in the region. And I thank you for your attention today.
Thank you, John. You're not objecting so much to the power that farmers have an additional soft landing on the power rates, but the fact that they're pumping water, period. You just want them to pump the water?
No, Chair Brown, I don't think that's accurate. We want to see better management of water in the basin, and we believe that market rates of power would help encourage better management of water in the basin. What the Yeager study shows is that there are tens of thousands of acres of marginally productive land that become profitable when people don't have to pay market power rates. And so it encourages irrigation of lands that are on slopes and that otherwise would not be productive without this highly subsidized power rate.
And on your last page in your testimony, it says Oregonians get nothing in return for the $20 million subsidy. What do you think they should get?
We think they should get better resource management in the Klamath. We think they should get better management of the Klamath River dams. We think they should get something for the $20 million investment. And as this bill stands, they get nothing.
Any other questions? Representative Kitts.
Clarification, then I go to my question, because you just, what does better management of the dams mean to you?
Well, there's no volitional fish passage at those dams. There ought to be volitional fish passage. There are water quality issues associated with those dams. There ought to be water quality considerations taken into effect. And some of those dams may have outlived their usefulness.
Follow-up.
Can I ask my question? In your testimony on the second paragraph, it says the last sentence midway through, it says hyphen Klamath Basin irrigators, comma, yet there have been no discussions regarding long-term implications of undoing this protection, referring to your previous two paragraphs. What kind of discussions did you want to have? I'd be more than happy to sit here and listen to it.
Chair Brown and Representative Kitts, we believe there ought to be a public airing and more public involvement in a matter as precipitous as this.
More public than the state legislature?
Well, the legislature is a public forum. Yes, you're right. But I don't think Pacific Corps ratepayers, as a rule, are aware of what is happening with this bill. And I'm not sure that the people who will, in effect, pay this $20 million as ratepayers are aware this is happening. And I think those people ought to be aware of it.
Go ahead.
Any other questions? Representative Gilman.
Sean, you say you're not in favor of the bill originally also. Is that correct?
The bill that 81? These amendments attached to?
No. I read your testimony saying that you don't even agree with differential rates in peak periods. Is that correct?
Chair Brown, Representative Gilman. We are not rate experts. However, we believe that it is sort of a camel's nose under the tent scenario to be carving out specific groups of ratepayers and accepting them from the non-discriminatory rate structure that generally applies in Oregon.
Any other questions? Jay, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony, please?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Jay Ward. I represent the Oregon Natural Resources Council, a nonprofit conservation group based in Oregon, dedicated to preserving the waters, wildlife, and lands of Oregon for future generations. It's because Senate Bill 81 threatens the quality of Oregon's waters and wildlife that I come before you this morning. It's a little unusual we're even talking about Senate Bill 81 since the last time we saw this language is it was in Senate Bill 1058, a copy of which I've included in my testimony. But since 1058 didn't make it out of the Senate, it's changed titles and now sits before you today. It's fitting that it comes before a committee, this committee, and based on protecting electricity consumers in Oregon. Unfortunately, the bill delays and likely prevents long overdue equitable treatment for the majority of Pacific Corps ratepayers. To understand Senate Bill 81, it helps to have a little history lesson starting around 88 years ago. There was discussion by earlier witnesses that it began in 1956. Actually, in 1917, President Woodrow Wilson was in office. We were just in the middle of World War I. Model T cost $360, brand new. And California and Oregon Power Company was selling electricity at one-half to seven-tenths of a cent per kilowatt hour for a lucky few residents of South Central Oregon. That rate was originally part of a complicated transaction that gave California and Oregon Power Company, known as COPCO, the right to develop and use Upper Klamath Lakes as a hydropower reservoir. In return, COPCO, now Pacific Corps, provided various benefits to the ownership, to the United States Bureau of Reclamation, including ownership of Link River Dam. A lot has changed since 1917, but not the cost of electric power to the fortunate few in the basin. Unfortunately for them, the rest of COPCO's ratepayers pick up the difference. Hospitals and schools and Deschutes and the Rogue Basin farmers all pay more for their electricity, so the Reams Country Club and other high desert irrigators can pay next to nothing for theirs. The 1917 contract, by the way, was renewed in 56, and actually the price went down at that point from 0.6 down to 0.3. Cents a kilowatt hour for many of the users. Thankfully, it's scheduled to expire next year. Senate Bill 81 prevents or delays that. You probably wonder why ONRC and other conservationists care about equitable electric pricing. In addition to our interest in equitable treatment for all Oregonians, we're specifically concerned with how this subsidy affects the natural hydrology of the Klamath Basin and its fish and wildlife. In order to enable irrigated agriculture on quite marginal lands, a lot of those lands are former marsh and lake bed. Much electricity used in the Klamath Basin powers water pumps that annually dewater our national wildlife refuges and rivers. More recently, more wells have been drilled, wells that require electric pumps. This pumping has resulted in tragic consequences for native wildlife, from the lake's white pelicans to the threatened coho salmon of the Klamath River. In 2002, we suffered a fish kill that's been estimated by California Department of Fish and Game at 80,000 salmon. Those fish are not just important to conservationists. Native American tribes and commercial fishing communities depend on them. Senate Bill 81 denies those communities the water and ultimately those salmon. In fact, the entire South Coast commercial salmon fishery, as Mr. DeVoe noted, has been impacted by the scarcity of Klamath River salmon, so much so that Representative Hooley has asked the federal government to declare many coastal fishing communities disaster areas. So it's not just Pacific River ratepayers who are subsidizing unprofitable irrigation practices. Native American communities, as well as commercial and sport anglers, also pay, albeit in a different currency. The solution to the Klamath Basin's vexing problems is not to continue this giveaway, especially without negotiating other agreements that restore the watershed. The solution lies in reducing the demands for water in the basin, and as you know, restoring market prices to the basin will likely reduce that demand. This should occur sooner rather than later. When that happens, folks in the Klamath Basin would start paying the same rates as other Oregon farmers. Hopefully that would encourage people to be a little more efficient in how they use their water and electricity. That would be a good thing for fish and wildlife, and a good thing for the farmers as well. There's a good reason we don't allow utilities to give preferential treatment to some classes of ratepayers. Despite some clever sleight of hand with this legislation, 81 carves out a huge exemption and penalizes thousands of Oregon ratepayers, most of whom don't know it, in order to create that exemption. I hope that if we've learned nothing else from Enron, it's that creative rate and credit schemes can have dire consequences. I'd like to avoid those controversies and consequences. Let's restore fairness to the Pacific Core ratepayers. And I urge your no vote on Senate Bill 81. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jerry. Will this allow the farmers or the irrigators to pump more water than what they are now?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, it will enable them to do what they're doing right now in the constraints that the federal government, the Bureau of Reclamation, has set up for them, and to the extent that the water gods provide us with enough precipitation to pump anything.
Okay, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that more water is going to be pumped from this aquifer. I assume that's where the water is coming from. And aren't those controlled to a certain extent by the by the state of Oregon as to how much water can be pumped? Are the irrigators a certain amount, the acre foot allowed or something from each well? Or they just pump all they want from these wells?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, the amount of water being pumped from the wells is a matter of some discussion. One of the real shortcomings right now is we don't have accurate metering in the basin of how much is being pumped from the wells or moved about the basin's irrigation project.
But this wouldn't necessarily allow more water to be pumped, though. It may just allow it to be maintained or possibly maintained. And so to be more likely to be less as opposed to more, right?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, this would not result in a net decline in the amount of water being pumped off the refuges. And a net decline and a reduction in water demand is what's necessary to restore both the basin's hydrology and the Klamath River salmon.
Thank you, Jay. Any questions? Representative Gilman?
Yeah, a question. When you flood irrigate, you use a certain amount of water, and when you use sprinklers, you use a certain amount of water. Electricity enables farmers to sprinkle. Don't you think that's a better thing?
Well, Chair Brown, Representative Gilman, somebody who hauled a lot of irrigation pipe during college, it's certainly a more efficient way and a more cost-effective way than flood irrigation. I don't think those are the two choices we have before us. Flood irrigation is certainly not a principle we should move toward at this point. I would submit that while there may be some increase in flood irrigation should this go through, the reality is there's not enough water down there to even flood irrigate should they want to do it. And so it's a matter of both supply of water and supply and cost of electricity.
Just one more. I think part of the reason for that rate was, though, the idea of falling water and that they could use that principle of flooding rather than than air pumping and sprinkling when they originally based that rate.
Chair Brown, Representative Gilman, I would agree that was the original hypothesis behind it. I think right now we've got a situation. I think it's Tule Lake where we pump about 7,000 horizontal feet of water up Sheepy Ridge right now in order to keep certain lake beds dry.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't think that Jay was making any reference to your age when he was talking about Woodrow Wilson, so I just want that for the record.
I'm the only one on this committee who's close enough to you.
Jay or John, I don't care who answers my question. You both are probably fairly capable of doing it. If these marginal lands that you speak of, if in fact we did not irrigate these lands, crops wouldn't grow. Is that fair to say?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, a lot of these lands are National Wildlife Refuge and former lake beds that would be, from our perspective, more valuable as fish and wildlife habitat than they are as potato and onion fields. We're one of the only National Wildlife Refuges in the country where commercial agriculture has a co-equal management priority with fish and wildlife. And what that means is every May, right about now, that there's a whole lot of pumping getting rid of water off the fish and wildlife refuges and sending it down the river to dry them out so you can plant. And then in the summer, when we need more water for the duck and geese and pelican populations, that water is not available because it's already sent down the river and you have to pump groundwater in order to irrigate the crops later in the season. So, yes, this will result in less arable land, but that's not a bad thing. Farming in the Klamath Basin is a tough prospect. It's at about government camps elevation. It gets less rainfall than Tucson, Arizona in a normal year. So it's not that great a place to be growing water-intensive crops.
And if I may, Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, the Yeager report describes the lands that would primarily go out of production under a market rate of electricity. They're primarily Class 4 and Class 5 lands. And my understanding, we're talking about roughly 7% of the total irrigated acres in the Upper Basin, but only about 3.5% of the net income from irrigated agriculture in the Upper Basin. These are mostly pasture lands, is my understanding. And they aren't necessarily associated with working farms. They are people who, some of them have a side business going, raising a few cows, and they irrigate the pasture to keep the cows there.
Thanks.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Jay and John, you've raised some significant concerns here for me on this bill, but I guess the one question I have would be about the livelihoods of the people who are currently working the land. Are you suggesting that there aren't a whole lot of people here that are depending on this farmland for their livelihoods? And if so, will this put them out of business immediately, or are you saying that the transition period should be different, or what recommendation are you making?
Chair Brown, Representative Shields. A lot of these landowners are out-of-state absentee landowners, if you will. We believe that one of the components of a solution, and this may be one of the components, but only as part of a comprehensive plan, one of the components would be a buy-down in water rights for willing sellers in the basin. In fact, Senators Smith and Wyden produced a bill, I think it was 2001, that provided $175 million to do just that, so that you're basically allowing people to retain their presence on the land, their ownership of the property, but they're willingly foregoing their water rights. And there was a great deal of interest in that from a number of Klamath Basin irrigators who hold water permits and recognize that it's a tough prospect to make a living down there. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes. Thank you.
Any other questions? Again, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Is there a senator? What's it? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chair Brown. Committee, for the record, I'm Doug Whitsett from Senate District 28. This is Greg Addington. Greg is the Executive Director of the Klamath Water Users Association. Contrary to some of the testimony that we've heard here this morning, I went home this weekend, and Sunday morning my wife and I were sitting on a swing looking out across Po Valley from our place and thinking, this looks more like heaven on earth than a polluted dump. All Pacific Power and Light customers benefit from the low-cost hydropower. This was originally a value given for a value received contract, the run of the river for the low-cost power that the Bureau of Reclamation had planned to develop for the basin but had traded to COPCO. As long as the hydropower is still being generated down the river, all Pacific Power and Light customers benefit from that. Addressing the issue of who will go out of business first, the people that will go out of business first are those who are lifting groundwater, because the cost is directly related to how far you have to lift the water. So if your groundwater is down 50 feet or 100 feet or 300 feet, you know, that's just a linear equation. The further you have to lift the water, the quicker you're going to go out of business. The lands that are involved in that are primarily above the lake. Those are some of the most productive cattle pastures on earth. And as right now, the cattle production in Oregon is one of our primary agricultural mainstays. The original contract for the off-project water users occurred in 1956, when then Pacific Power and Light wanted to enlarge their project on the river. And they recognized in that contract that the irrigation activity actually enhanced the flow of the river by pumping water and by flood irrigating to essentially refill the sponge so that the water flowed back into the river later in the season and enhanced the flow in August, September, that part of the year. There's actually a USGS study that was done on the Sprague River in the year 2000 that validates that assumption, that in fact the more flood irrigation is done in the early part of the year, the better the flow of the river is in the late part of the year. And finally, in 1956, the Klamath River Compact was written, and this is an agreement between Oregon and California and ratified by Congress, and it has the full force of a federal law because it was ratified by Congress. And in that compact, they recognize that there was a exchange of river flow for low-cost power, and in that compact, they require that low-cost power is maintained in perpetuity. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Don't see any. You want to go ahead and give your testimony, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Addington, Executive Director for the Klamath Water Users Association. And, Mr. Chair, I hadn't originally intended to come up here and testify. There's my organization, which we represent the people on the project in the Bureau of Reclamation project, and we certainly appreciate this legislation. One of the difficult things for us was that we're not ready to say that we're giving up on our power rate, because this issue is going on a couple of fronts at the federal level with FERC and the relicensing, and as was mentioned earlier, at the PUC level. And so we're actively engaged in those two forums and think that we're going to do well and think we're going to win there. This legislation came about thanks to Senator Whitsitt and the off-project folks. And quite frankly, we look at it and say, hey, a safety net is not a bad idea. I mean, you can't predict what's going to happen in these other forums. So we're happy to be here and supporting the legislation. The reason I decided to come up here is when I heard that most of the the irrigators or landowners in the Klamath Basin are out-of-state landowners or don't live in the basin. And I knew then that the more than 1,400 family farms and ranches that I represent in my association, who are third and fourth generation farmers and ranchers in the basin, would want me to come up here and put the record straight on that issue. Again, I think Senator Whitsitt did a good job of talking about some of the issues that were brought up. The discriminatory rate that you hear of and the subsidy, the fact is both parties benefited from that contract. That's why it's there. It wasn't just a giveaway. The discriminatory rate, the Klamath River Compact, as Senator Whitsitt pointed out, clearly sets that rate, and it's approved by the states of Oregon and California and by the federal government. And I think the one other thing I'd like to point out is we heard mention of the Yeager study, that irrigators won't be going out of business because of this power rate. I would suggest two things. One, if they were not going to go out of business, I don't know that some of our friends here with ONRC and Water Watch would be here. I mean, that to me, that is what they want to see happen. They think that agriculture in the basin is a bad idea. We disagree. The Yeager study is flawed. I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you that it doesn't take into account irrigators will be charged twice, really, for a power increase. Once through their individual pumps, and second, because almost all of them belong to districts, which do a significant amount of pumping. And when the districts have those costs, they're going to pass those back to the landowners. So there's a double hit there. So I guess I'll just wrap it up and say that, we look at this as the 7 years mitigation as a safety net, and what it will do is allow people to transition to other ways of doing things if things go bad with the power rate, or it'll allow them some kind of an exit strategy if that's what's needed, instead of cutting them off at the knees right away. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Greg, could you tell me what, say, a typical irrigator, what it costs them a day to pump to irrigate their land with? I know it would depend on the size of what they're irrigating, I'm sure. But.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I can't answer that for you. I should be able to. I'm relatively new on the job down here, but and I don't know if anyone else, Senator Whitsitt, has an idea. I think it varies a lot, and it depends on which district you're a part of, because some of the districts have very, very large pumping facilities to move the water around in that basin. And I would just point out, too, that as far as efficiency, that the Klamath project is 93% efficient in water use. There is not wasted water in that system. You won't find anything better as far as the reuse of water.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Schaffler, where'd you come from?
I briefly sit in on this bill, but I was in Klamath 2 years ago as I was on the Water Committee, Klamath Falls, and I understand that there have been some studies that show that before the system was even there, that more water evaporated out of those lakes than actually goes into the streams now. They have more water going into the streams due to the system. That's what someone told me. I don't know if you would like to comment to that or not.
I would comment to that. The Bureau of Reclamation produced a study, or had a study produced, that modeled the basin, the entire basin, as it was prior to European man's arrival, to try to determine what the hydrology of the basin would have been at that time. And what they determined backs up what we see in some of our older photographs, that from time to time the Klamath River below Klamath Lake was actually dry in late July and August because there was no flow. The only reason there is flow in the river in dry years is because of the water that is stored for irrigation purposes. And the primary shortage of water that we have is because that water that has been stored for irrigation has been reallocated for other purposes, namely for endangered suckerfish and for threatened coho salmon downstream.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on the amendments there, Senate Bill 81?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. I'll be very brief. We just want to put some things on the record in terms of our understanding. CUB is neutral on these amendments. We are participating in the PUC process that's been mentioned here a couple of times. We do believe that the contract rate ought to be ended. That's what we are testifying to. We're actually in agreement with the company on that. This is an ending of a 50-year contract. We've known for 50 years that these are that the end of that contract period is coming. However, our understanding of these amendments is that although it does have some discriminatory rate-making, it's, in our view, it's fairly narrow in application. We just saw these over the weekend, and we're still reviewing that, but our initial read is that there's a very narrow application. In our view, even setting a seven-year limit makes us feel a little bit better. We have some work still ahead of us at the PUC to make sure that the that if you do decide to adopt this amendment, that the seven-year kick-in actually does happen. But in our view, even if this didn't happen and the PUC did whatever it was going to do, we might have to wait for the next rate case to get all of the to get these irrigators back on a better rate. So for us, the 7 years offers a little bit more security, but security that we'll have to work to make sure happens. And then finally, Section 3, sub 6 says that the full cost of providing rate credits under this section shall be spread equally among all other customers of the electric company. That's a decision that will be made through the PUC process, and there's several different ways where spread equally could happen, and we'll be looking at making sure that the spread equally is done fairly through the PUC process. With that, those are the only things I wanted to put on the record, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, in your view, what would happen if we did not pass these amendments to the farmers that are living in Klamath Basin?
Actually, that's an answer to that question goes a little bit beyond my scope and my expertise. What I know would happen if these were not if these amendments were not taken in terms of process and rate making is that the PUC and FERC and the other regulatory processes would make a decision, and if the determination was made to end the contract, there would be a substantial rate increase. Again, we've known for 50 years that the end of those contracts are coming. And again, CUB is not part of the FERC process. We are part of the PUC process. And again, we don't know what the PUC would decide. And here again, we feel we put some sidebars on the conversation so that if contract does come to an end, and again, that is the outcome that we are advocating for, it makes... it gives a little bit of additional security that we can make sure that in 7 years irrigators are either on a contract or on a rate closer to other irrigators that are off that were not originally a part of this agreement back 50 years ago. And that they can, they have another 7 years to figure out what to do.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff,
I was thinking somebody from the PUC might testify on this because I'm still kind of concerned whether the PUC is okay with the dash three amendments. But I have a question specifically about the discriminatory, I guess, part of this, that we're creating a different class of ratepayers. Is that different rate based on using electrical rates during off-peak hours, as opposed to just saying these ratepayers here are going to get a better deal than everybody else? Is it when they use their power?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question exactly. I know that, actually, frankly, I might kick that to the PUC and take a dive on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't say any thank you, Jeff. Yeah, I'll get someone from the PUC.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Willis, Executive Director of the PUC, and I wanted to put on the record that the PUC, while it hasn't taken a formal position, has no problem with the dash three amendments.
Thank you. Did you have a question, Representative Holden?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could, maybe I didn't ask that question real clear, but can you answer me the fact that we're giving better rates to these folks in the basin? Is it based on them using a lot of power during off-peak hours, or is it just based on where they live?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you ask it
again?
Yeah, maybe
the question doesn't make sense. I don't know.
I think historically these rates have been set because of the water used for generating electricity. I don't believe there was a on-peak, off-peak difference. But it was for the use of that water to generate electricity, so the irrigators in that area got a preferential rate.
Right, so it doesn't have anything to do with whether it's off-peak or on-peak hours.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I don't believe
that. Okay, that was my question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, sir. Thanks. Appreciate your testimony. Committee, we are still in the we're in a work session, and Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to the House, Senate Bill 81.
Representative Kitts moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 81. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was anticipating on voting in favor of this bill in light of the amendments which I've just seen. There have been some significant concerns raised enough that I will be voting no.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Gillen.
Aye.
Representative Holt.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Gillen.
No.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Garrard indicated to me he'd like to carry the bill on the floor. We'll open a, let's see, where are we at on this? We'll open a what? We have never heard this.
No.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 328. And Janet, please get us up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 328. May look familiar, and you should have the A engrossed version of the bill. It is identical to House Bill 2008, which this committee passed and did pass the House floor. The bill, if you recall, exempts prefabricated residential structures, so prefab homes from intended delivery in another state from certain construction requirements imposed on homes built in Oregon. It would allow electrical and plumbing installation in the structure, structure's manufacturer, again, if they're intended for delivery in another state, to be formed by persons that are not licensed as electricians or certified as plumbers. These affect modular homes. It does not affect other manufactured homes. Mr. Chair, the vote in the Senate was 26-0, and there is minimal fiscal impact, so you don't have a fiscal impact statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Morris and Representative Early, please. Good morning, gentlemen.
You want me to go first, sir? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senate, District 8. This may look a little familiar to you, and I just walked in, so I'm not sure what kind of discussion was.
We just got started, Senator. Janet had mentioned that this should look very familiar to this committee, that we'd heard it with the different numbers, the only difference in the bills so far.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your willingness to schedule this bill and continue its progress through the assembly here. The exciting thing about this bill, I believe, it's kind of a rare breed in that it's one of the few direct jobs bill that we will produce in this session. It's an opportunity for our current manufacturers of manufactured housing to enter into a market that has been foreclosed to them, and that is by virtue of our building codes that restrict any construction of what's considered to be a modular structure to the site-built codes. And this bill very simply allows the manufacturers to build to the codes to the states in which they ship the product. For example, and you'll hear testimony from Forrest Barnes from a major plant, Palm Harbor, in my district in Albany, provides them an opportunity to address a market that's been foreclosed to them, and that's shipping their product out of state. This precludes any possibility of the product coming back into the state unless it has the approval of our DCB Department of Consumer Building Services and that stamp that would be required to site the facility back into the state of Oregon. So it's an excellent bill, and I would encourage your continued support for this this bill for the state of Oregon and jobs in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, the City of Bend, and I appreciate you having the hearing on 238, Senate Bill 328 today. As stated earlier, this is like deja vu all over again. House Bill 2008A, which is the one that you saw before, was passed out and was passed by the House on a 53-6 vote. And in the meantime, the Senate did unanimously pass this bill, which is a virtually identical bill. I'm not going to go into detail on what this bill does. There's others here, I think, that will address that. But I do want to address why this is so important, not only to my district, but the state as a whole. I believe all 90 members of this legislative assembly agree in the goal that we need to do what we can to protect the jobs that we have right now and create an environment that will foster more job creation. And we may not always agree on the means to achieve that goal, but I think it's safe to say that all 90 of us would agree on that goal. This bill is one way to achieve that goal, and it's one that I believe we should all be able to support. There is currently a company, Fuqua Homes, located in Bend, that is in the manufactured home business. They've been in business for over 30 years. Recently, the company added 70 more jobs, bringing the total employed to nearly 200, and these are good family wage jobs. But things are not always as rosy as they may seem. Recently, Monaco Coach announced that it was closing its plant in Bend, resulting in nearly 500 family wage jobs being lost. There are a number of reasons for this announcement, but suffice it to say, I believe it could have been prevented. I don't want to see the same happen to Fuqua Homes. Brian Grawl, who is the general manager of the company, and I've handed you his written testimony and apologize he was not able to make it over this morning to testify in person. He was recently quoted in the May 18 edition of the Cascade Business News saying that this bill represents, quote, a tremendous opportunity for providing job growth, not just for Fuqua Homes, but also for other builders considering modular home building in Oregon. And I'd like to call your attention to his written testimony, the last paragraph on the first page, where he says, again, I quote, speaking conservatively, if just an additional 400 modular homes were added to the current HUD business, Fuqua Homes would enjoy employing an estimated 100 to 130 more persons to fulfill its human resource needs. Or put another way, add almost another $4 million in payroll. The principal opposition to this bill, as was the case with House Bill 2008A, will come from the electrical, plumbing, and other unions who want their journeymen to be involved in the manufacturing process, and also from government bureaucrats who want more inspections. But I ask you to please rise above the partisan politics and recognize this as a good bill that we should all support for protecting the existing jobs that we have and creating even more. And again, I respectfully urge your support of Senate Bill 328A. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you referred to some opposition, I know there were six no votes on the House, and I was one of them. You know, and, you know, I'm not going to die on my sword on this one, but I just, you know, the one piece for me was the licensed plumbers and licensed electricians being able to do electrical and plumbing work in these product lines, and I realize the situation of it, you know, being production line type of work, but I just don't understand why, you know, these licensed plumbers and electricians can't build to, you know, the codes and requirements of other states. It seems like they're the ones that are most familiar with that trade, and so I mean that's the only thing I have against this bill. Really, I fully support building to the requirements of the other state. There's no need for us to build to the requirements to Oregon when we're selling in California. Perfect sense. I totally support that. But I do have a concern of, you know, continually undermining a group of folks who are, you know, licensed electricians, licensed plumbers, that have a great deal to do with the economy of our state. And so I just hate to see them get paid less and less and less and lose more and more jobs. So that's really the only thing I've got against this bill, you know, to be fair. It's just that one little piece. But I fully support the bill. I'm sure it'll go through despite my objection to it. But I just wanted to put that on the record. And those jobs that unfortunately left Bend are, you know, now in Coburg, as you may know, that they didn't leave the state. They just shifted over to their main plant in Coburg, where they're a little, just a, I guess, a business decision by that company. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kitts.
Now, I share the same concerns as the good representative from the Emerald Empire. As I was corrected the other day on the floor. But I would also outweigh those concerns with the sensitivity of the type of work these folks are doing and err on the side of jobs for Oregon every day of the week. And I would also say, in clarification, as with the Monaco Coach going from Bend to Coburg, nobody's losing any jobs by these requirements. These are just simply requirements that are not up to specific standards of other trades. And in fact, if this bill passes, jobs would be created and not lost. There would be no loss of jobs as a result of this bill, just simply a differentiating of requirements to provide this. So I just wanted to state that for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for testifying this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for hearing this bill again. It's been very much, very much appreciated.
We needed a refresher. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have Don Miner and Forrest Barnes, please? Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of ANGRO Senate Bill 328. I want to begin by thanking the speaker for allowing this bill to be heard, and I'd also like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for scheduling it. As your committee administrator indicated, you'd heard most of this before, so I won't give you the full treatment, and I'll be brief in my remarks. SB 328 is nearly identical to House Bill 2008. My understanding is Section 6 and 7 were reversed in order, and I think that's the only change that I'm aware of. This legislation will allow the manufactured housing industry to create manufacturing jobs in Oregon where none exist today. There are no electricians and no plumbers today building modular homes in Oregon, or at least none to speak of. That business hasn't existed in this state since the 1970s. It isn't the building standards so much as just the process in Oregon that is makes modular homes not a viable opportunity in this state. The homes, in fact, will be built to standards in California that are virtually identical to the Oregon standards. The bill allows manufacturers in Oregon to build modular homes to the requirements, licensure requirements, inspection requirements, etc., of the state where the home will actually be placed. The bill is restricted to residential dwellings only. Oregon has 10 companies building manufactured homes in the state. It's the 10th largest producer in the United States. About 60% of all the homes built in the state are exported for consumption in another state. The industry has had a hard time in the state in recent years. In 1998, the manufacturers directly employed about 3,390 employees and paid them a payroll of about $103 million. In 2003, that had shrunk to 1,800 employees and $67 million. They need more production to maintain their production infrastructure. These aren't low-wage jobs. I've given you a handout talking about the benefits. They're very good jobs, actually. The Oregon Code, again, is not the code of the state of California, or the requirements down there are different. To require manufacturers in Oregon to build to Oregon requirements and California requirements will make the product non-competitive. It just simply won't be viable in the marketplace. The state of Idaho has a code and requirements. And again, it's not so much the building code, 2x4s and wires and plug-ins, things like that. It's more the process in Oregon that doesn't work. Idaho process is very similar to Oregon, also didn't really work well. In 2004, that legislature passed a measure almost identical to 328. That allows modular homes built in that state to be built to the state, the standards and requirements of the state where it will be consumed. The homes are not required to meet any of the Idaho requirements so long as they do not come back into that state. The Idaho manufacturers are now producing modular homes for delivery in especially California, where they're competing with site-built products. Giving you a photocopy of a picture of the houses being built up there in Boise, Idaho for delivery into California. That product is a very attractive product in that state, and they are now taking away business from Oregon manufacturers. They are substituting manufactured homes there with modular homes. Our manufacturers simply like to be able to build in the state. The homes are being built in other states for delivery to California. In summary, this measure will allow Oregon manufacturers to compete in the interstate modular business. It does not compromise the safety of Oregonians or Californians or anyone else. It does not cost anyone a job in this state. In fact, it'll expand employment. And I request your support.
Thank you, Don. Forrest, would you like to give me your testimony?
For the record, my name is Forrest Barnes, division president of Palm Harbor Homes. I live in Albany, Oregon. Chairman Brown, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. We believe the California market is the largest opportunity to build houses in America. But unfortunately, when we get a call from a developer looking for products, as I passed out to you today, we refer them to our Arizona facility where they build those products. It's good for Arizona. It's not good for us here in Oregon. Our industry is really an export industry. At my facility, we export over 60% of the homes we build. Those go to states outside of Oregon. So we think that our industry is an excellent example of providing employment in rural Oregon counties. And we think that that helps lower unemployment. If you're in Linn County is one of the higher unemployment areas in the state. This legislation would allow us to produce the two-story homes, which I've shown you. In our operations throughout the United States, Palm Harbor has factories that integrate both HUD-code and modular homes. This occurs in North Carolina, Florida, Texas, Ohio, Alabama, and Arizona, but not in Oregon. Our president and CEO, and I just returned from Dallas last week, again asked me, what is the status? What are you doing? They don't really understand why it is so hard to attain what we do in the other states here in Oregon. And I tell them it is a difficult process, and we're working on it. As an industry and as a company, we see our jobs filling the need to boost manufacturing jobs. That's really a buzzword around here, manufacturing jobs. We have 40-hour weeks. We provide paid holidays, vacation, health benefits, and retirement plans. The jobs are family wage position filled by both men and women. In Linn County, I believe the average wage is right around $28,000 a year. Our average wage exceeds $34,000. Working for Palm Harbor Homes is a great job in Linn County. At our peak, we employed about 350 people. Today, we're at 257. I like to get those jobs back. We have the plant, which we have is about a $12 million investment. We have both plant and land down there to expand. And we think that this bill will help us do that as we reach further to expand our markets. Thank you. I urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Tim, you had some testimony this morning, too. Morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman of the committee, what's left of you? For the record, my name is Tim Nichol. I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I represent thousands of highly skilled tradespeople in the state. I want you to know right off the bat, I'm only speaking to a very small part of this bill, lines 12 and 13 on page 1, and lines 29 through 31 on page 7, having to do with exemption from licensing. I can't in clear conscience let this bill just carry on without at least bringing up a couple of points. One of my passions is the fact that I was around long enough back in the early 70s to know what the old Oregon blue card was. That was the electrical license in the state of Oregon. We only had one electrical license. It was revered throughout the country. I know this because I spent a number of years working on the road when times were bad in Oregon. Through the years, and the reason that this is bothering me is through the years, legislation has gone through to chip away at that licensing. There's now over 21 different electrical licenses. I want to bring up the fact that, you know, when you're taking away, and I'll even stay away from that. I'll just be real short here. I got to mention a couple of things besides that. And one of those is back in the early 80s, I remember I wasn't part of this, believe me, but there was legislation created that exempted licensing for industrial products going out of state. It had to do with the oil modules. Coming out of Coos Bay going to Alaska, it had to do with missile launchers coming out of Astoria and going to Vandenberg. Both of these cases, it was a complete disaster having people coming in off the street not knowing how to build these, how to do the proper wiring. All of these units had to be amended and fixed, and it gave our state a bad eye. The couple of little things that have to do with this licensing in this bill that I don't quite understand is residential isn't really defined in this bill, and I still can't get anyone to explain to me the difference between modular and manufactured. So I just wanted to express my concerns. I'm naive, but I'm not naive enough to know that I'm going to affect this bill. I just in clear conscience want it on the record, because my passion is trying to get us back to where we are the most revered state, and I got to remember that people do live in these structures. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions? Jim? Thank you again for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 328A and standard ease for a minute here.
We could do the hearing on e-call, shall we?
What about the other two? Hearing on Senate Bill 327A, and Janet, can you get me up to speed? Or us up to speed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 327, and you should have the A in first version, prohibits debt consolidating agencies from receiving a fee from their client until the first installment is paid to the creditor, and would authorize nonprofit debt consolidating agencies to charge credit counseling fees under specified conditions. It would require an agency to disclose in writing their maximum charges for service and client responsibilities, and clarify that agencies commit improper debt consolidating practices when they provide services without first providing this disclosure form. The bill did pass the Senate on a 26-0 vote, and has no fiscal impact. It was introduced at the request of Jan Amling for the Consumer Credit Counseling Services of Lynn Benton County, and Senator Morrison and Representative Olson are the chief sponsors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Morris and Jan. Thank you, Senator, for your patience with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing our bills. That's very much appreciated. This issue was brought to my attention by Jan Amling, as the administrator mentioned, from Albany, and I would like to have her address the issues of need, why this issue is important. It's really a consumer protection bill, and one that with the emerging growth of services to persons in credit need, managing their credit responsibilities, that we make sure that they're not abused in this process. And that's what this bill very simply does. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to defer to Jan and have her share with you the issues and why this bill is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Jan, I see you have almost 3 pages of written testimony. I hope you'll summarize it for us.
I would love to summarize it for you. Thank you very much.
We would love you to as well.
Consumer Credit Counseling Service was established in the 50s to work with families that were in financial distress. I have been with Consumer Credit Counseling Service since 1979 and have watched the evolution of a lot of industry changes on the part of banking and, therefore, our reactions to what the creditors have been doing with families. Over the years, our industry has changed, our part of working with families, and there have been a lot of people that have determined that this looked to be a lucrative industry to be in and have sullied the waters rather incredibly, to the point where the Federal Trade Commission, the IRS, and the Senate and the House have had hearings, all of this happening within the last couple of years, to try and get to the bottom of what has been happening. The worst part of what's happened is that some of the people that claim to be not-for-profits actually have a for-profit part of them that has been siphoning off billions of dollars of profits from this industry. So the IRS, Federal Trade Commission, and, like I say, the Senate and the House have been working on some ways to clear this up. What our bill is trying to do is, because the federal bankruptcy legislation passed and is going to go into effect in October, it is going to point basically all filers for domestic filers to an agency such as ours for financial counseling. There is no ability, according to ORS 697, for us to charge fees for this service. And so, therefore, the agencies would have no way to hire the additional people that are going to be necessary to do this counseling. We are already seeing other creative groups that are saying that they are going to be presenting or offering these types of services to expedite families. The one that I have seen was by a person that does bankruptcy counseling, and he's going to give up his bankruptcy counseling portion of his practice and set up this nonprofit so that he can give the people the stamp of approval that they can take to the bankruptcy court. And so there needs to be we need to keep the process within the nonprofit sector. We need to be able to fund this. We need to be able to charge a fee for our services. And so the DCBS in the past has been willing and is apparently still willing to set fees that we could charge. In the past, they set it for our educational needs, how much we can charge for education. And so we would be asking DCBS to be able to have hearings and determine what types of fees we could charge for various types of counseling, including bankruptcy counseling. Now, the other parts of this to help the consumers are that no fees that we charge would be able to be assessed to families without them receiving in writing prior to the counseling session what the fees would be, and that the family understands they have an obligation to pay the fees if they're going to be assessed. Of course, the fees could be waived, but it's to give the families in writing a notification that there are expected to be fees. Part of this is because of those people that are out there that are doing bad work are retaining the first month's deposit that is supposed to go to creditors or keeping it for their fee. So it's not uncommon for us to have families that send us $1,000 a month to send on their bills. And so these egregious people are hanging on to the full $1,000 for their fee. And it's in very small fine print that families don't understand that these are the fees that are being charged. So by having the family acknowledge in writing before the counseling session that there are going to be fees if they use the services and what those fees would be, that is going to be helping the consumers. And let's see. I think there's the third portion is that we cannot retain any fees if the family sends us to go to the creditors. We cannot retain any of those fees until we've sent money to the creditors. So what this does is if your deposit to us is $1,000 to go to the family, we can't keep that $1,000 until we have sent money to the creditors. So until we've sent the money out of the house, we cannot retain a fee. And I think that most of the people that are in this industry are smart enough to know that if you've notified the creditors that family's going to go on the program, the creditors have re-aged the account, that to then retain a month's fee after that is going to then foul up the whole arrangement with the re-aging process, and the OCC says that they can only re-age the account once in 5 years. So they will have fouled up the family irreparably. So this makes sure that the family's fees go to the creditors before a fee is retained by the agency. So those are the probably what you may seem technicalities of what we're doing.
Thank you, Jan. Any questions? No, I don't see any. I represent Shields. You're about to disappoint me.
Boy, you keep waiting that long. Who's going to think of one?
You got to move quick. Jan, is there anything in either federal or state statute that requires nonprofit credit counseling organizations to be 501c3 organizations specifically?
That is where I think that is how the attorneys are getting around it. It just says that I believe that they have to be nonprofit. They have to have a board of trustees. They have to demonstrate that they have a separate account for trust funds. There's a whole list of things that whoever's going to provide this counseling has to do. All of the consumer credit counseling service agencies that are part of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling already meet those standards. But I'm not sure specifically about spelling out the 501c3, and I think that's how the attorneys may be getting around it. And I'm not sure what kind of nonprofit they would be setting up that would not be a 501c3, but there could be some other section of the code that they're doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, folks. Thank you, Jan, for your testimony. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327A and open the work session on Senate Bill 327A. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 327A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 327A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Gelman. Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Fitz.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Escobar.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar?
No. Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
I'd move 327A to the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 327A to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection in the consent calendar? Open a work session on Senate Bill 328A. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 328A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That's the one we just did. Yeah, Senate Bill, Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 328A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, again, I would echo the concerns of Representative Holvey, and if, in fact, that proves to be a problem in the industry, that the quality of these structures are not what they should be, that it comes back before the legislature or that the industry itself corrects the problem, and I have all the confidence that they will. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Don't see any. Katie, call roll, please.
Representative Colby.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chalford.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gelman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Carrier on the floor.
Okay.
Representative.
Carried last time.
Did you?
I said, who carried it last time?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I think Representative Kitts will be here.
This time? I think I. Yeah.
No! What? Representative Kitts will be the carrier on the floor.
Mr. Chairman.
I wish Holvey carried that.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move to suspend the rules for the purposes of letting Representative Holvey change his vote from the other.
Out of order.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 117. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We don't have any testifiers. Yeah. Okay.
I think we're in the wrong order, though.
Okay. Go ahead, Janet. Sorry to interrupt you.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 117 is the first of four bills that were introduced by DCBS and particularly the Oregon Medical Insurance Bill. The first bill, Senate Bill 117, would create an additional category of eligibility under the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool for individuals who meet the qualifications of the Federal Health Coverage Tax Credit Act and the criteria that will be established by the OMIP board. The bill does have a fiscal impact, and that should be at your place. There is also a dash one amendment that was requested by the agency. The Senate vote on this bill was 23-2. And, Mr. Chair, the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Janet. Rocky, please.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. I also have with me Tom Jovic, who is the program manager for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. He is my lifeline this morning. If you ask a question, I am unable to answer. I note the time, so I'm assuming that you would like me to give a high overview summary. Just as a quick reminder, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is the state's high-risk pool. That is, if you are out there and need health insurance and you don't work for a company that provides group health insurance, you have to get individual coverage. If you have cancer, MS, or some medical condition, you're going to be denied. And OMIP is what it's referred to, is really the insurer of last resort. Likewise, if you lose your group coverage and are unable to obtain portability coverage through your carrier because you move to Southern Oregon or to Bend or your company goes bankrupt, we will provide what's called portability coverage. So we have both medical coverage for those that are denied coverage because of medical reasons. We also provide portability coverage for people who lose group coverage and have no other options. The Senate Bill 117 creates a third eligibility category, and that is for people who have lost their jobs because of the Federal Trade Act or who are receiving benefits under the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, i.e., freight liner goes bankrupt and you don't have any benefits, you lose your health insurance, your pension. And the federal government has decided to provide a tax credit up to 65% of the premiums for those individuals who have been displaced because of the Trade Act or under the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation if they enroll in what's called a qualified health plan within the state. Oregon has no qualified health plan, so the decisions among the OMIP board and some of the carriers was to designate the high-risk pool as the state's qualified health plan. And so it would create a third eligibility so that for those people who are seeking that federal tax credit to purchase health insurance, because, again, they've lost their job because of the Trade Act or because they've lost their job and their benefits through bankruptcy of an employer, they can come and enroll into the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and, as a qualified plan, receive that federal tax credit. There's about 1,700 Oregonians right now that would qualify. I should tell you, though, that no state has seen, I think, more than 3-5% of those eligible that actually take advantage of the tax credit. The fiscal impact you have before you, I think, assumes that all 1,700 would come in, so it's about a $30 million fiscal impact. But the reality is you're going to see somewhere around the 5% would be the actual impact from an expenditure standpoint. There are no state funds. We receive all our funding from premiums that the insurers actually pay us, and then through an assessment of insurers to make up for any losses that those enrolled in the program incur. So there's no state general fund, and we will, before the, it won't be the Ways and Means, whichever budget committee is going, we'll be looking at a small increase in our limitation of other funds. That's a summary, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions, Rocky?
I should add, the amendment that we proposed was requested by the Department of Treasury to ensure that we got both the Trade Act enrollees and the those people eligible under the benefits
Pension
Guarantee Corporation. And we've got some, also, I believe, some testimony that's been submitted to you in support of the bill by people who would be eligible.
And I know you just touched on it briefly, and you just talked right over my head. If in fact this third arm, if you will, or third tier coverage is put in, and I see that there's a $30 million, and that's assuming the full, not the 3-5% that you spoke of, whether it's 3-5 or 50%, where's that money going to come from to pay for those services. And I'm sure you covered that, and I'm sure it's right here in front of me. I'm just not able to understand it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, the pool is funded really with two mechanisms. First of all, we charge premiums to anybody who's enrolled, and they pay those premiums. And we basically, that's up to 125% of what they would pay in the regular market. So if you went to ODS or Blue Cross and it was $200, we could charge by statute up to 125% for similar coverage. But these people that come into the pool, very frankly, I mean, they have very serious health conditions, MS, cancer, name it, they have it. And so we have the ability to assess insurers in the state of Oregon who provide health care coverage on the basis of the number of people they cover in Oregon, a pro rata amount to cover any losses. And when I say we have the ability, it's the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Board that has that by statute, the ability to do that. For every dollar in premium we collect, we expend about $1.60 in claims. So about 40% of our income comes from the assessment of insurers. The board is made up of 9 individuals, 5 of which are representatives of insurers. So it is really the insurers assessing themselves.
Follow up. Thank you. How many, if your board is made up of 9 insurers, how many insurers are there around the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, actually the board is made up of 9 individuals, 5 of which are insurers, 2 consumer representatives, a provider, the insurance commissioner, I believe, makes up the full 9. And of those insurance companies that we assess, I believe it's about 180 to 190 each year pay assessments, that covers, they cover about 1.8 million, 1.7 to 1.8 million lives in the state.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the intent of the chair is with this bill.
It refers to budget.
Today. Mm-hmm. I would like some more time on this bill, and I don't want to take the committee's time to ask my questions. I would just as soon set up a meeting if the chair is okay with that. If the chair wants me to give a courtesy vote, I'm fine with that. But I would ask that we postpone this bill to a date certain so that it does come back. But I don't want to take the committee's time to vet it, because I've got a litany of questions that I don't want to go into. But that's just where I'm at.
Okay. Any other questions? My concern is that the we are down to probably the last week of our committee life, and it does have, and they're in the process of putting bills together, budget bills down there together now. And
if it pleases the chair, and I don't know what the schedule's like for tomorrow's evening work session, the chair has scheduled. We're on a 24-hour notice.
We couldn't bring it back tomorrow evening.
If the chair would indulge me with just that and allow me to set up a meeting between sometime today and get my questions answered, I would appreciate that if it's okay with the committee.
We squeeze it in, Janet? Yeah, okay. We can do that. Any other questions? I don't see any. Just stay put, though, Rocky, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122. Janet.
Mr. Chair, second bill in the series, Senate vote 22-3. This bill does not have a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It has no fiscal impact and would modify the assessment reduction program of OMIPS by adjusting the assessment of an insurer based on the insurer's contribution to reducing enrollment in OMIPS. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Rocky?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. The Senate Bill 122 allows the board some flexibility in what we call an assessment reduction program, whereas the current statute says they shall have a program. This change in this legislation really says they may have a program. And just let me kind of briefly tell you what that is. People deny coverage and they come to the pool. We wanted to find a way to incent carriers not to turn people down. rather than to reject them that come into the pool, can't you please accept them? And so the board, and this goes back to 1997, under statutes that were came out of the legislature at that same year, designed an assessment reduction program to give credit to certain insurers if they reduced the rejection rates so that less people would come into the board. However, the markets have changed since 1997 considerably, both in terms of how business is conducted, and at that time we only had, I think, a rejection rate in the general market that was probably between 8% and 12%. The rejection rate in the individual market now has gone to almost 30, in some cases higher than 30%. Carriers have really clamped down on who they accept and the risks they'll assume. So the board just wants the authority, when the insurer sat down and really looked at this, to really pull back on the assessment reduction program for right now, because it's a different market, it's a different environment, but they don't want to lose the ability at some point, if something new pops out of their head or someplace on a national basis, that they can incorporate to give carriers some incentives to accept more people. They would like to come back and revisit the assessment and reduction program. So basically, it's a shall now. They would like to end the current assessment reduction program but retain the authority to come back at a later date and reinstitute it. I should tell you that the carriers and the board can do nothing without the full approval of the insurance commissioner, so any program they put forth has to be approved by the insurance commissioner also. There's no opposition we know of to this bill among any of the carriers, and certainly not the board.
Does this bill mandate anybody do anything?
No, it actually, Mr. Chair, allows them to a may rather than shall. It changes a shall to a may, so it gives the board some flexibility, given the current market conditions, to design a different assessment reduction program.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 122 and open the work session on Senate Bill 122. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 122 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Representative Basketball.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Foley.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 122 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 122 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 130A. Janet, again, please.
Thank you.
Or maybe Rocky can just go ahead and tell us what it is.
Quicker than me getting my folder out.
Right.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Rocky.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. Senate Bill 130A modifies the current statute that allows an agent basically to refuse to apply to a carrier as a method for which a person can enroll in a pool. Let me just back up. There's a couple ways a person can get into the high-risk pool. The first is to apply to an individual market carrier. They're turned down. They come to us. The other is if they go to an agent who says, I'm sorry, but because of your condition, it doesn't make any sense for me to apply. You're going to be turned down anyway. So the agent writes a letter on behalf of that individual, and they come into the pool. During the 90s, that represented about 4 or 5% of those people that came into the pool was because an agent wrote a letter. That has increased to almost 40%, 30 to 40% now. Part of that is because of the high rejection rates I talked about earlier of the carriers. They don't want them to go through the hoops. What this does is basically allow the board to set that way of getting in the pool aside and develop a list of specific health conditions so that an individual who has cancer will have a form, can check it off, who has MS can check it off, and they can actually go straight to the pool without having to go through an agent. This, we believe, is consumer-friendly and allows for a little bit speedier process for individuals to come straight to the pool, that if they still want to go to an agent, they can do that to help them get into a regular market, but if they can't because of their health condition, they can come straight to us without having to go through a health insurance agent. This has received the endorsement of the pool, of the pool board, and we don't know of any known opposition, although there are some agents who would like the opportunity to earn a fee by having them go through them. We think this is very consumer friendly.
Any questions?
I have.
Representative Gilman.
Rocky, you mentioned some of the ways they get in the pools. Is one of them that the rate is just too high?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, no. The rating, it is in our laws, our statutes, it says if you are charged a above standard rate for health insurance, you can come into the pool. However, Oregon has a law that does not allow carriers to health rate. You know, if you come into our pool and you have asthma, we're going to charge you $20 more a month. Oregon law does not allow for that. So we've never had to use our statute that allows for people to get into the pool because of too high of rates.
Any other questions? Janet?
This bill has -83 amendments that are gut and stuff. It includes things that agency needed as well as conflict amendments with another.
This is an active one, isn't it? Mr. Chair, this there was a list of conflict amendments that was drawn up by legislative counsel as so that if one bill passes, I believe, and the other one doesn't, and it kind of pulls them all together. But it had one substantive a change to it also. Current statutes for OMIP say that if you're eligible for Medicaid, you can't get into the pool. And the problem is that there are some Medicaid packages that have less benefits than what the pool offers, so it doesn't make policy sense. It really relates to back in the 90s, early when benefits in Medicaid were much, much higher than they are today. This allows for the board to say basically that if your Medicaid meets or exceeds the benefit package that's offered by OMIP, only then would you not be allowed to come in. If it's less of a benefit, you would have the option of taking your Medicaid, or you could come into the high-risk pool. But this allows the board to basically say if your Medicaid package meets or exceeds the benefit package by OMIP, you would have to take Medicaid at that time. This goes really back to the formation of the pool back in 1989 by the legislature, where they wanted to make sure, and part of the deal struck was that OMIP didn't take a lot of folks that were eligible for Medicaid.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Rocky. Mm-hmm. And that will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 130A and open a work session on Senate Bill 130. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 130.
Representative Escobar moves the adoption of the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 130. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? And none are adopted. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 130 as amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Chalmers.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Think it's safe on the consent calendar?
I'll move to put it on the consent calendar.
Representative Esquel moves Senate Bill 130 to the consent calendar. Is there any objection?
We'll find out.
None. Order.
Mr. Chairman?
Right.
If the chairman desires to open a work session on Senate Bill 117, I had my question answered out in the hallway just now, so I'm
fine. You're okay. Okay. Open the work session on Senate Bill 117.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 117.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 117. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 117 as amended to the Committee on Budget.
Do we have to
rescind
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I would move that we rescind the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means and refer Senate Bill 117 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Budget.
Thank you, Representative. That is a mouthful.
Just say what he said.
Scary.
I agree with what he said.
That's scary.
With a due pass recommendation.
I said, yeah, rescind the Ways and Means, refer the bill as amended to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation.
And we got that all down. Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Shields. Aye.
Representative
Esquivel. Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Pitt.
Aye.
Representative
Shaw. Aye. Motion carries. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 123. Rocky again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. Senate Bill 123 does five things, and if you have copies of my testimony in front page right down below, I give kind of a list of those. Let me go through those really briefly. The first is changes the date of the count of insured lives. I mentioned earlier that we assess insurers. It's based on how many people they have enrolled in their health benefit plans. That count is done as of December 31st of each year. The carriers have really asked that we change that date to, I think it's March 31st, to reflect the plan changes and that occur from one carrier to another during the first 2 months of each year, January and February. So as we start to assess those carriers, it would just give us a more accurate and more up-to-date count over that next year when we do those assessments. The second change is to change the lifetime maximum benefit limit. The OMIP was established in 1987 and funded in 1989, and at that point we had $1 million lifetime max, and that was based on what was going on in the market today. Now you have lifetime maxes as $2 million, $3 million in some cases like Kaiser or HMO Oregon when it was still going where they have no lifetime maxes. The second change just gives the board the flexibility to change the lifetime max to keep up with what the regular market is. Third one is exceptions to the 12-month re-enrollment waiting period. OMIP has within statute a law that says once you leave OMIP, for whatever reason, you can't come back for 12 months. Well, there are situations when people leave. The reason for that is they wanted people to make sure that they didn't come in and get their health condition taken care of, leave OMIP, not pay the premiums, and, I got to go to the doc again, and come back into OMIP. So once that's just contrary to the concept of insurance. So they had this 12-month waiting period. However, there are instances where individuals leave OMIP, they go get group coverage. They leave that group coverage, want to come back to us for portability coverage, but we have to say, I'm sorry, you have a 12-month wait. So the board would like the authority to develop exceptions when it makes sense for those people to come back. There's not game playing. It's just the circumstances of their employment or whatever it was kept them from maintaining their coverage, and they ought to be coming back to the board. That's the third point. The fourth, we are by law only allowed to contract for our third-party administration
discussion with licensed insurers. This prevents the board from developing a separate contract, for example, with a disease management company, or, for example, to go to OHSU and say, you have a centers of excellence in a certain transplant. We want a direct contract with you to take advantage of the state and our leveraging. We have to go through the insurer and use basically whoever they use or their rates. This would allow the board some flexibility to bring in some pieces, case management or centers of excellence, in addition to our third-party administrator, and they would like that flexibility. Again, all these have no opposition on part of the board. And finally, point five, create benefit plans for medical eligible enrollees. By law, everybody who comes into the pool has to have a benefit package offered to them that is basically designed on the state's portability benefit matrix. It's a benefit matrix that is approved by the Department of Consumer Business Services. What the board would like is some additional authority to address the specific needs of some of the enrollees that we have in the pool to be able to have special benefit packages or more comprehensive benefit packages that are designed on the broader group market rather than the portability market. We think this is consumer friendly and we'll be able to provide greater flexibility in some of the benefit designs for those people with chronic health conditions. That's a quick summary at 1029, Mr. Chair.
Looking good.
I got every bit of it, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it's all locked in up here now.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I believe the good representative from the Emerald Empire has a guest that he might want to introduce to the committee that's walking to the back of the room, and I think we'd be honored to meet him.
Representative Holt.
Well, thank you, Representative. I was going to wait until Rocky was done and we voted this out, but I have some family in back, mostly my son back there in uniform, who's at the Capitol Days in transition to a better place than he was, and his name's Justin. Hey.
How's it going? Hi, Justin.
Welcome home.
Sir. Where was he?
Where was he?
Well, after being in the SUNY Triangle for a year, he's been at Fort Hood, and he's being transferred up to the Army Hospital Madigan Medical Center, I think, up at Fort Lewis, a little closer to home.
Well, thank you very much for all you do for us. Thank you for your service.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, is the bid representative going to introduce him on the floor today?
Yes, sir.
Because I wouldn't want to let Representative Nelson down by not giving you a standing ovation right here. But we will be giving you one this morning on the floor, I'm confident.
Much deserved.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the indulgence.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there is a conflict amendment that also is requested by the Legislative Council, and there is a small fiscal impact that relates to some of the additional benefits that and costs that be incurred with these. I believe it's about $160,000 for the first biennium, and 2007-09, it could be as much as $300,000.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rocky. Any other questions? Don't see any. We need to rescind referral and send it to budget, right? Mm-hmm. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -1 conflict amendments into Senate Bill 123.
Oh, let's see. First off, I've got to get us in a work session. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 123 and open the work session.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the conflict -1 amendments into Senate Bill 123.
Representative Kitts moves the -1 conflict amendments to Senate Bill 123. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? It's ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I would rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee and refer Senate Bill 123 as amended to the Committee on Budget.
Representative Kitts. What's it called? With due pass?
With the due pass recommendation, I apologize.
Representative Kitts made the motion to send it, rescind Ways and Means referral, send the bill to budget with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill, 385. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 385 was pre-session filed. By the General Government Committee at the request of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, the American Society of Appraisers Oregon Chapter, and the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers Rose City Chapter, and the Oregon Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. It provides that an appraiser certification and licensure board, which is one of Oregon's semi-independent licensing boards, has the authority to discipline state registered appraiser assistants as well as the other licensees get licenses, and allows the board to retain the civil penalties and license-related fees that they have for their operating costs. There is an emergency clause on the bill. You also have a -A3 amendment that provides a conflict amendment in the case that House Bill 2029 passes. And, Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal impact statement because some of these civil penalties are now directed to the general fund.
Thank you, Janet. Someone signed up to testify? What was the number? 385.
That's fine. Right there.
There they are. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Zitlock. I'm a real estate appraiser from Newport, and I serve...
From Newport? That's right. I know where your office is at out there on Highway 20. Excuse me, friend.
Mr. Chair, I know where she can get a good deal on some tires.
And I do.
Has.
I serve as a board member on the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. I'd like to introduce Bob Keith, administrator of the board. Bob has a few comments and will answer any questions. Thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, I'm going to make this very short. What she said. She just about hit a home run as far as what my testimony
is. I need your name.
I'm sorry, Bob Keith, the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board.
Thank you.
I apologize. I'd be happy to answer any questions. The key point is as Janet Atkins had indicated, that appraisers across the state are in support of this bill. They requested the bill. They recognize and understand the importance of effective appraiser supervision and regulation, and also the impact that this bill will have potentially for enhancing public trust and public protection. And so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair, I've just got one quick question. Why the dollar amount? How do you get there?
Which dollar amount?
You're on your A3 amendments, fiscal. Lines 18 through 24, it outlines the civil penalties. First violation, not less than 100, but not more than 500. Second violation or subsequent violations, not less than 500, but not more than 1,000. I'm just wondering if those are germane to existing law for...
They are existing. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's all right. No. You can interrupt me anytime.
In that case.
Yeah, except for you. Yeah. So it's existing?
It's existing.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, you can see the same language that's deleted on page 3 of the amendment.
I got you. Thank you.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you kind of give me an appraiser assistant does things I assume that the appraiser himself isn't aware of, and that's when he would come up, or does... Seems like the appraiser would always have say-so over the assistant, or everything he does, at least look it over. So I'm just wondering, is the assistant going to become a scapegoat, or, is he actually operating without the appraiser's knowledge on some things?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, that's a good question. And the answer is that the appraiser assistant is given a certain amount of latitude at the appropriate time to perform and to function as an appraiser, ideally by the end of their training period, just the day before they become licensed or certified, they should be fully functioning as an appraiser. And while it's true, a supervising appraiser does have responsibility for the work of that individual, they're not there at every step and every judgment that's made during the appraisal process. The key factor or the key feature of this bill, one of them is the with respect to the disciplinary action that could be taken against the board, actually just being able to deny somebody's registration application is something that we're not able to do by statute right now. And so if somebody comes to the board with a conviction, whether it be sexual assault or financial fraud type of thing, we have to give them appraiser assistant registration. And we will not have an opportunity to deny them a license until they make application for a license.
Follow up. Just one real quick. So this bill doesn't then relieve the appraiser of making sure the assistant's doing things correctly and I'm sure gross situations.
Yes. Chairman Brown and Representative Holby, that's exactly correct. It does not relieve the appraiser of their obligations to supervise the assistant.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 385 and open the work session on Senate Bill 385. Representative Getz.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 385 to the floor. I'm sorry, I move the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 385.
Representative Getz moves the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 385. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted. Representative Getz.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 385 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Has a referral done it?
Does it ever? No. I don't think so.
No. Okay. Excuse me.
But if you want it to, Mr. Chairman, we can refer it anywhere you want.
We'll refer it to the floor. Representative Getz moves Senate Bill 385 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carried.
Same calendar, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shoffler moves that Senate Bill 385 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar.
May we like them.
Thank you. Janet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Oh, great.
Oh, terrific. Yeah.
I knew you'd like it.
We're looking forward to that.
Sunshine and you might as well be.
It's going to be hot tomorrow, so you don't want to rush out into that hot air. You can stay in there.